6, and feeling very little. Back in his room, he masturbated, then fell deeply asleep and had not been troubled in his sleep. When in the grip of the fantasy, he could not restrain his impulses. He admitted to one person that he had felt very good when he first realized that his initial victim was indeed under his control. Several different mental health professionals who interviewed him all agreed that he was intelligent, IQ 125, alert, and more than a little pleased at all the attention he was receiving. They categorized him as a 301.20 in the numbering scheme of the Standard Manual of Psychiatric Disorders, that is, suffering from a schizoid personality disorder with compulsive features. Among the several psychiatrists who evaluated Joubert during this period was Dr. Herbert C. Modlin of the Menninger Clinic, who made the following observations about Joubert and reported to the court. "This man seems not to know what love and affection are, as though he has never experienced such feelings. In describing his relationship with his sister, the best he could do was say, 'We didn't hate each other.' It is striking that this intelligent man could not describe either parent. He seems so separated from emotional experiences as to suggest some sort of chronic dissociative process. I suspect that he is dimly aware of this defect or lack in himself, and in part the homicides were an attempt to experience strong emotions." Dr. Modlin reported that he had many unanswered questions about Joubert and his crimes. Why had the victims been 13-year-olds? Why had they been strangers to him? Why had they been stabbed? And why had Joubert made multiple cuts? Why had he partially removed their clothes? Why had the abductions taken place in the early morning? Many of these questions continued to bother me, although I believed I had some insight into the answers to a couple of them. There was more to be found out, however, and a tremendous leap forward in our understanding of Joubert and his crimes came through another chance happening. In the fall of 1984, I had brought back to Quantico with me slides and other documentary aids about the slayings and the killer, and was using the case as an example in an FBI NA class. As I presented it, one of my students raised his hand and asked to see me during the next break. Lieutenant Dan Ross of the Portland, Maine Police Force said that the Omaha murders reminded him of an unsolved case in Portland. I was excited because when Joubert had been arrested in Omaha, I had suggested that the authorities there check back to his previous Maine address and look for earlier crimes that might have similar characteristics. Although I had initially believed the Eberle killing to have been the suspect's first homicide, after learning more about him, I had come around to the suspicion that there could well have been earlier preparatory crimes. His fantasy was just too strong not to have erupted in antisocial behavior at some earlier point in his life. Also, his relatively abrupt enlisting in the Air Force could have been a way to get himself out of town cleanly and without being noticed after the commission of an early crime. Omaha had been too busy with other aspects of the case, however, and an initial call to Portland by the Sarpy County authorities had drawn a blank. The lieutenant went home to Portland for the weekend and returned with the files on the unsolved murder case. One of the other students in my class that quarter was a police officer from Sarpy County with whom I'd worked in the Joubert investigation, and the three of us sat down to go over the files. The circumstances were very much the same. Just before dawn, a lone boy as the victim, an attacker who had also been described by witnesses as young, and who clearly knew the area, a slashing death, bite marks on the victim. This terrible event had occurred in August 1982, a bit more than a year prior to the Eberle abduction, and just before John Joseph Joubert IV entered the Air Force. Ricky Stetson, 11 years old, blonde and blue-eyed, had been out jogging over a regular route that took him near a highway viaduct. On a hillside close by the viaduct, he had been stabbed to death and his body mutilated, though not so severely as the later victims. The murder had occurred just at daylight. The killer had attempted to pull off the victim's clothes, but had only been partially successful. Examining the crime scene photos, I learned that photographic evidence had been taken of the bite marks on the victim and that the photos had been preserved. We checked back through Joubert's records and learned that years prior to the time of that murder, Joubert had been a paperboy with a route that was contiguous to the hillside where Stetson had been stabbed and bitten. More recently, Joubert had worked at a company whose plant was close to the site. Witnesses recalled seeing the jogging boy followed by a young man on a 10-speed bike. Most of those witnesses, shown photos of Joubert, thought that the assailant had been Joubert, but after several years of intervening time, couldn't be 100% sure. With some difficulty, Dan Ross went to the Nebraska State Prison and obtained bite impressions from Joubert, which were then shown to experienced forensic odontologist Dr. Lowell Levine, director of the Forensic Sciences Unit of the New York State Police. Dr. Levine was convinced that Joubert's bites closely matched those taken from the victim. As the Portland case developed, the trail of crimes committed by Joubert eventually led back even further, as I had suspected it might. In 1980, there had been several unexplained slashings, one of a 9-year-old boy and another of a female teacher in her mid-20s. Both victims had been cut rather badly and were lucky to be alive. Back before that, in 1979, a 9-year-old girl had been stabbed in the back with a pencil by a boy on a bicycle who had sped past. There was not much use to indicting Joubert on those charges, but the Stetson murder demanded an answer. Joubert was eventually indicted and convicted for that murder in Maine. Should his sentence in Nebraska ever be commuted, he would have to be transported to Maine and imprisoned for the remainder of his life. In essence, the solving of the Stetson case in Maine was an early and informal triumph for what would become the VICAP system. In this instance, it was the fortuitous circumstance of having a man in my class who could connect two murders in different states with the same M.O. Once VICAP was up and running, that sort of comparative analysis would be available to the authorities whenever a serious crime was committed. My own interview with Joubert had to wait until the court processes in both Maine and Nebraska had been exhausted years later. I took along Special Agent Ken Lanning, our BSU expert on child abuse, and an agent from the Omaha office. Joubert had put on some weight in prison and finally looked like a young man rather than an overage boy. I had learned from the prison authorities that he had been drawing on tissue paper in his cell on death row, and these drawings had been seized and taken from him. They were quite good, well drawn, but what they showed was chilling. One depicted a boy by the side of a road, hogtied, and the second was of a boy on his knees as a man slid a knife into him. Every ounce of information we can extract from a killer about his mind and methods gives us more ammunition to track the next one. Joubert didn't want to talk to us at first, but eventually my long interest in his case and the techniques I'd learned to apply in my interviews of more than 100 murderers got him to loosen up a bit. I asked about stresses in his past, and it was then that he recalled that before he had started to hurt anyone, he had lost a friend. This was when Joubert's mother refused to help him find the boy, and Joubert was bereft. Shortly afterward, his descent toward murder began. In our interview in prison, he rather plaintively asked me whether the FBI could help him find this lost friend. I said I'd try. He admitted the murders, and we started talking about the details. Among the many subjects I wanted to explore, I was particularly interested in three matters: the unexplained bite marks, the detective magazines, and the way he had chosen his victims. They were all related. He told us about the fantasy of cannibalism that had been with him since the time he was 6 or 7 years of age. The working out of that fantasy had been the engine of his murders, and it had encompassed biting the bodies, including that of the first victim back in Portland. Presumably, the slash marks on Eberle's leg, that tic-tac-toe pattern that had puzzled us, had been his attempt to obliterate the bites he had made in that area. I asked him whether he had learned from detective magazines that the police could identify a killer through forensic odontology on such bite marks, and he agreed that he had. One of the reasons that he read such magazines was to get information on how to avoid detection. The main reason was stimulation. For him, as for many killers, detective magazines were pornography, even though they showed no depictions of nude bodies, only suggestions of dominance, torture, and the like. I asked him when he had first started reading those magazines, and he said that it had been at about age 11 or 12 when, in the company of his mother, he had seen them on a rack in a grocery store. He had been excited by the depictions of people being frightened and threatened, and had gotten his hands on one of the magazines and used it as a prop for masturbation and his fantasy of strangulation and stabbing. So the magazines had been associated in his mind with both sexual excitement and killing for nearly a decade prior to his murderous actions. And, at the time of first equating those magazines, his fantasy, and sexual self-stimulation, Joubert had been a prepubescent boy, fair-haired and slim, with a bike and a pre-dawn paper route. After 6 or 7 hours of talking, Joubert asked me a question. "I've been fair to you, Mr. Ressler, so can you do me a favor? Get me a set of the crime scene photos. There's something that I have to work out in my mind." This young man, then 28 years old, was on death row for these crimes, and he still wanted depictions of them, probably for the purposes of masturbation. I told him I was unable to comply with his request and left the interview having gained the sad understanding that John Joubert's terrible fantasy would most likely not die until he did. In 1992, he remains on death row. 6. Organized and disorganized crimes. To most people, when confronted by evidence of violent criminality, the behavior may seem an enigma, even a unique occurrence. Very few of us are used to grisly murders, mutilations, bodies thrown into ravines, and the majority who are ignorant of such matters includes most local police who seldom encounter crimes of this sort. Even outrageous, unspeakable criminal behavior is not unique and not incomprehensible, however. These sort of murders have occurred before, and when properly analyzed can be understood well enough so that we can even break them down into somewhat predictable patterns. By the late 1970s, the Behavioral Sciences Unit had accumulated a large amount of experience in assessing these sort of crimes. The usual police officer might never have seen an act of disembowelment or cannibalism during his career, but because so many police departments sent us their unusual cases for analysis, we were used to looking at such crime scenes and could get past the average person's disgust at them and discern what the evidence revealed about the probable perpetrator. Amassing this knowledge was one thing. Communicating it to our audience, those police officers who sought our help in tracking down violent criminals, was another. To characterize the types of offenders for police and other local law enforcement people, we needed to have a terminology that was not based in psychiatric jargon. It wouldn't do much good to say to a police officer that he was looking for a psychotic personality if that police officer had no training in psychology. We needed to speak to the police in terms that they could understand and that would assist them in their searches for killers, rapists, and other violent criminals. Instead of saying that a crime scene showed evidence of a psychopathic personality, we began to tell the police officer that such a particular crime scene was organized, and so was the likely offender, while another and its perpetrator might be disorganized when mental disorder was present. The organized versus disorganized distinction became the great divide, a fundamental way of separating two quite different types of personalities who commit multiple murders. As with most distinctions, this one is almost too simple and too perfect a dichotomy to describe every single case. Some crime scenes, and some murderers, display organized as well as disorganized characteristics, and we call those mixed. For instance, Ed Kemper was a highly organized killer, but his mutilation of bodies after death was more typical of a disorganized one. In this book, I'll paint the principal characteristic of both classic organized and classic disorganized offenders. Please remember that if I say that a particular attribute is characteristic of an organized offender, it is not so 100% of the time, but is something that is generally applicable. For instance, I say that the organized offender hides the bodies of his victims. In our research interviews and in analysis of crime scenes, we found this to be true more than 3/4 of the time. That's enough to make the generalization hold up pretty well, but not enough to make it an absolute condition for our characterization. All of the rules of profiling are like that. Though the distinction between organized and disorganized itself is very apparent once recognized, the list of attributes that go along with each of the categories has grown, over the years, as we have learned more details about these murderers, and it continues to be enlarged. When trying to figure out whether the crime has been perpetrated by an organized or disorganized offender, we look at crime scene photographs, and if possible, we examine information from or about the victim. For instance, we try to assess whether or not this particular victim meant a low risk for the criminal. It would be a low risk if the victim was frail or weak. Where did the victim become a victim? When Monty Rissell abducted a prostitute from a deserted parking lot in the early morning hours, he chose a victim who might not be missed for some time. Knowledge that the perpetrator would deliberately choose such a victim can be important in trying to apprehend him. We ordinarily divide the crime into 4 phases. The first is the pre-crime stage, which takes into account the antecedent behavior of the offender. Often this is the last stage about which we finally obtain knowledge, though it is the first in temporal sequence. The second phase is the actual commission of the crime. In this stage, we place victim selection, as well as the criminal acts themselves, which may include far more than murder, abduction, torture, rape, as well as the killing. The third phase is the disposal of the body. Whereas some murderers do not display any concern about having the victim found, others go to great lengths to avoid its discovery. The fourth and final phase is post-crime behavior, which in some cases can be quite important, as some offenders attempt to inject themselves into the investigation of the murder or otherwise keep in touch with the crime in order to continue the fantasy that started it. The major attribute of the organized offender is his planning of the crime. Organized crimes are premeditated, not spur of the moment. The planning derives from the offender's fantasies, which, as I've shown in earlier chapters, have usually been growing in strength for years before he erupts into overt antisocial behavior. John Jubert had his crimes in mind for years before the opportunity for a slashing murder presented itself, and he crossed the line into action. Rissell, too, had had violent fantasies for years before a likely victim showed up in that parking lot after the night when, in his mind, he had been spurned by his former girlfriend. Most victims of organized offenders are targeted strangers. That is, the offender stakes out or patrols an area, hunting someone who fits a certain type of victim that he has in mind. Age, appearance, occupation, hairstyle, and lifestyle may be elements in the choice. David Berkowitz looked for women who were alone or sitting with men in parked cars. The organized offender often uses a ruse or con to gain control over his victim. This is a man who has good verbal skills and a high degree of intelligence, enough to lure the victim into a vulnerable area. Control is of the essence for the organized offender, and law enforcement personnel learn to look for control as an element in every facet of the crime. An organized offender might offer a prostitute a $50 bill, give a hitchhiker a ride, assist a disabled motorist, tell a child that he's taking him to his mother. Since the crime has been planned, the offender has devoted time to figuring out how to obtain victims, and may have perfected the ruse. John Gacy promised money to young men in a homosexual transient district in Chicago if they would come home and perform sex acts with him. Ted Bundy used his charm, but also the aura of authority that some police paraphernalia gave him, to lure young women into his car. With the organized killer, the victims are personalized. The offender has enough verbal and other interchange with the victims to recognize them as individuals prior to killing them. The disorganized killer doesn't choose victims logically, and so often takes a victim at high risk to himself, one not selected because he or she can be easily controlled. Sometimes, this lack of choice produces a victim who will fight back hard enough so that later their body reveals defensive wounds. Moreover, the disorganized killer has no idea of, or interest in, the personalities of his victims. He does not want to know who they are, and many times takes steps to obliterate their personalities by quickly knocking them unconscious or covering their faces or otherwise disfiguring them. Therefore, the major attribute of the organized killer is planning, which in this sense of the word means that the killer's logic is displayed in every aspect of the crime that is capable of being planned. The disorganized offender's actions are usually devoid of normal logic. Until he is caught and tells us his version of the crimes, chances are that no one can follow the twisted reasoning he uses to pick his victims or to commit his crimes. During the criminal act, the organized offender adapts his behavior to the exigencies of the situation. After Ed Kemper shot two young women on a college campus, he had the presence of mind to drive past security officers at the gate with the two dying women in his car without alarming the officers. Though admittedly in a state of anxiety, Kemper was not on a hysterical shooting spree. He was able to adapt his behavior to the danger of getting past the checkpoint. Other murderers, less organized, might have panicked and attempted to drive through the gates at high speed, thereby attracting attention. But Kemper behaved as if he had nothing to hide and was successful in getting away with his crime that night. Adaptability and mobility are signs of the organized killer. Moreover, organized killers learn as they go on from crime to crime. They get better at what they do, and this shows in their degree of organization. If the police have a series of 5 homicides that demonstrate the same MO, we advise looking most closely at the earliest one, for it will most likely have gone down closest to the place where the killer lived or worked or hung out. As he becomes more experienced, the killer will move the bodies farther and farther away from the places where he abducts his victims. Often that first crime is not thoroughly planned, but succeeding ones will display greater forethought. When we see more planning in a later crime than in an early one, we know we're after an organized killer. The leap forward in criminal expertise is an important clue to the nature of the offender. In the previous chapter, I've detailed how evidence of improved criminal behavior helped refine a profile that led to the capture of John Jubert. Another offender who improved his crimes and steadily escalated them in violence was Monty Rissell. Only after he was caught and convicted for a series of rape murders did he confess that he had committed a half dozen rapes earlier in his teenage years, rapes for which he was never caught. He began by attacking victims in the apartment complex in which he and his mother lived. Later on, while at a youth facility, he forced a woman whom he abducted in a parking lot to drive to her residence where the rape took place. Still later, he drove a car out of state to find a victim. Each time, he made it less and less likely that he would be identified as the rapist. It was only when he reversed this pattern that he was actually caught. Rissell's last 6 crimes, of which 5 were murders, again occurred in or near the apartment complex where he lived. Even in that last series of murders, there was some escalation. With his first 3 murder victims, he made the decision to kill them during the rapes. With the last 2, he had consciously decided to kill them even before the actual abductions. Further evidence of planning that sometimes becomes available to police investigators lies in the organized offender's use of restraints, handcuffs, ropes, and the like. Many murderers take what we call rape kits along when they hunt victims so that they will not have any difficulty restraining those whom they wish to assault. The presence of a rape kit also allows the offender to have a submissive victim, something essential to his fantasies. We once assisted in the investigation of a bizarre sexual murder on a Bronx rooftop. We noticed that the murderer had not brought anything with him to immobilize the victim. He had taken his tools for that task from her own clothing and handbag. The absence of a rape kit helped us profile a killer who was not organized. Was there a vehicle used? To whom did it belong? Someone as disorganized as Richard Trenton Chase, I had told the police when his murders were still unsolved, would most likely have walked to the scene. I was certain of this, because I had decided that the killer displayed all the signs of a disorganized offender, one too mentally ill to drive a vehicle while at the same time controlling his victims. As the listener will recall, the part of the profile that really helped the police a good deal was my insistence that the killer would reside within a locus of a half mile from the site of his latest victims. Like Chase, the disorganized killer walks to the scene or takes public transportation, whereas the organized offender drives his own car or sometimes takes the victim's car. If the disorganized offender owns a car, it will often appear unkempt and in poor condition, as will his dwelling. The organized offender's car will be in proper condition. Taking one's own car or a victim's car is part of a conscious attempt to obliterate evidence of the crime. Similarly, too, the organized offender brings his own weapon to the crime and takes it away once he is finished. He knows that there are fingerprints on the weapon, or that ballistic evidence may connect him to the murder, and so he takes it away from the scene. He may wipe away fingerprints from the entire scene of the crime, wash away blood, and do many other things to prevent identification either of the victim or of himself. The longer a victim remains unidentified, of course, the greater the likelihood that the crime will not be traced back to its perpetrator. Usually, the police find the victims of an organized killer to be nude. Without clothing, they are less easily identified. It may seem a very large step from wiping away fingerprints on a knife to decapitating a body and burying the head in a different place from the torso, but all these actions are in the service of preventing identification of the victim and of the killer. The disorganized killer may pick up a steak knife in the victim's home, plunge it into her chest, and leave it sticking there. Such a disorganized mind does not care about fingerprints or other evidence. If police find a body rather readily, that is a clue that the crime has been done by a disorganized offender. Organized ones transport the bodies from the place that the victims were killed and then hide the bodies, sometimes quite well. Many of Ted Bundy's victims were never found. Bob Berdella, a Kansas City, Missouri killer who, like John Gacy, abducted, tortured, and killed young boys, cut up their bodies into small pieces and fed them to the dogs in his yard. Many that were so treated could never be identified. A different dynamic seems to have been at work in the instance of the Hillside Strangler, who was later identified as two men. The victims were found, and the killers later turned out to have been quite organized offenders. Their desire seems to have been an egotistical one, to flaunt the bodies in front of the police rather than to conceal them in an effort to prevent tracing the killers through identification of the victim. An organized offender may sometimes stage a crime scene or death scene in order to confuse the authorities. Such staging takes a fair amount of planning and bespeaks a mind that is working along logical and rational lines. No disorganized offender is capable of staging a crime scene, although the very chaos of some crime scenes later attributed to disorganized offenders may at first give rise to various contradictory theories of what has happened at the site. When law enforcement personnel look at a crime scene, they should be able to discern from the evidence, or lack of it, whether the crime was committed by an organized or disorganized perpetrator. A disorganized crime scene displays the confusion of the killer's mind, and has spontaneous and symbolic qualities that are commensurate with his delusions. If the victim is found, as is often the case, he or she will likely have horrendous wounds. Sometimes the depersonalization of the victim by the attacker manifests itself in an attempt to obliterate the victim's face, or in mutilation after death. Often the death scene and the crime scene are the same for the disorganized offender. He does not possess the mental clarity of mind to move the body or conceal it. The organized offender often takes personal items belonging to his victims as trophies, or to deny the police the possibility of identifying the victim. Wallets, jewelry, class rings, articles of clothing, photograph albums, all of these, once belonging to victims, have been found in the dwelling places of organized killers after their arrests. Usually these are not items of intrinsic value, such as expensive jewelry, but rather items that are used to recall the victim. These trophies are taken for incorporation in the offender's post-crime fantasies and as acknowledgement of his accomplishments. Just as the hunter looks at the head of the bear mounted on the wall and takes satisfaction in having killed it, so the organized murderer looks at a necklace hanging in his closet and keeps alive the excitement of his crime. Many take photographs of their crimes for the same purpose. Sometimes trophies of the crime, such as jewelry, are given to the killer's wife or girlfriend or mother, so that when she wears it, only the killer knows its significance. John Crutchley was convicted only of kidnapping and rape, but I believed his actions to be extremely similar to those of an organized serial killer. He had dozens of necklaces hanging on a nail in his closet. Though Monty Rissell stole money from the purses of his rape and murder victims, he also took jewelry from them and kept it in his apartment. He further extended his fantasy involvement with the victims by driving their cars for hours after he had killed them. The disorganized murderer doesn't take trophies. Rather, in his confused mental state, he may remove a body part, a lock of hair, an article of clothing, and take it with him as a souvenir whose value cannot be discerned. As I have said earlier, all these crimes are sexual in nature, even when there is no completed sexual act with the victim. The truly organized killer generally completes a sexual act with a living victim, taking full advantage of the situation to rape and torture before murdering someone. Even if they are impotent in ordinary circumstances, while they are punching, slashing, strangling, and whatever, they are able to have sex, and do. The disorganized killer often does not complete the sex act, or, if he does, completes it only with a dead or entirely inanimate victim. The disorganized killer kills quickly, with a blitz style of attack. The organized offender seeks to increase his erotic interest through keeping the victim alive and performing perverted and destructive acts on the victim. Power over the victim's life is what this type of offender seeks. John Gacy brought his victims near death several times before the actual murders so that he could enjoy their suffering while he raped them. During rapes, the organized offender demands that the victim display submissive behavior and act fearful and/or passive. If a victim fights back, the organized offender's aggressive behavior usually becomes heightened, sometimes so much that a man who had originally planned only on raping a victim escalates his violence into murder when the victim resists. In stages 3 and 4, the organized offender takes steps to hide the bodies of his victims or otherwise attempts to conceal their identity and then keeps track of the investigation. He does so in order to elongate the time period in which his fantasy seems to be in control of events. In one particularly egregious case of post-crime fantasy, the killer was a hospital ambulance driver. He would kidnap his victims from the parking lot of a restaurant and transport them elsewhere for rape and murder. Unlike many organized offenders, he would leave the bodies in locations that were only partially concealed, and then would call the police and report seeing a body. As the police rushed to the location of that body, the offender rushed back to the hospital, so that when the call from the police came to the hospital for an ambulance to be dispatched, he would be in a position to answer that call. He derived a special satisfaction from driving the ambulance to the dump site, retrieving the body that he himself had killed, and transporting it back to the hospital. Organized and disorganized killers have very different personalities. the ways in which those personalities develop, and the behavioral consequences of those developmental patterns are often important to unraveling a crime. The disorganized offender grows up in a household where the father's work is often unstable, where childhood discipline is harsh, and where the family is subject to serious strain brought on by alcohol, mental illness, and the like. By contrast, our interviewing of murderers found that the organized killer's childhood was characterized by a father who had steady and stable work, but where the discipline was inconsistent, often leaving the offender with a feeling that he was entitled to everything. The disorganized offender grows up to internalize hurt, anger, and fear. While normal people also internalize these emotions to some degree, that's necessary in order to live together in a society, the disorganized offender goes far beyond the norm in his internalization. He is unable to let off steam and lacks the verbal and physical skills for expressing these emotions in the proper arenas. He can't be easily counseled because he can't tell the counselor very much about the emotional turmoil inside him. Part of the reason for unexpressed anger within the disorganized offenders is that they are not normally handsome people. They don't appear attractive as measured by others, and they have a very poor self-image. They may have physical ailments or disabilities that make them different, and they are not comfortable being different. Rather than accepting their disabilities, they believe themselves to be inadequate, and they act in an inadequate manner, thus reinforcing their hurt, anger, and isolation. Disorganized offenders tend to withdraw from society almost completely to become loners. Whereas many organized killers tend to be reasonably attractive, outgoing, and gregarious, the disorganized ones are incapable of relating to other people at all. Therefore, the disorganized offender will most likely not be living with a member of the opposite sex, and probably not even with a roommate. If they live with anyone else, chances are it will be a parent, and probably a single parent at that. No one else will be able to stomach their strange ways. So the disorganized offender is alone, possibly a recluse. Such offenders actively reject the society that has rejected them. Commensurate with these disorganized offenders' poor self-image is that they are underachievers. In general, they are less intelligent than the organized offenders, but most are not seriously deficient. However, they never live up to their potential, either in school or in the workplace. If they work at all, it will be at a menial job, and they are habitually disruptive because of their inability to get along with other people. They also accept that they underachieve. When the killer of the young woman on that Bronx rooftop was questioned by the police, he said he was an unemployed actor. That was wishful thinking. Actually, he was an unemployed stagehand, certainly by his own lights an underachiever in the theatrical profession. By contrast, the organized offender, rather than internalizing hurt, anger, and fear, externalizes them. This is the boy who acts out in school, who does aggressive and sometimes senseless acts. In years past, the public has believed that all murderers have been disruptive and outwardly violent in their childhoods, but that stereotype is applicable only to the organized offender. The disorganized boy is quiet in school, maybe too quiet. Often when he is caught for a heinous crime, teachers and fellow students from his childhood hardly remember him. And when his neighbors are interviewed, they characterize him as a nice boy, never any trouble, who kept to himself and was docile and polite. On the other side of the coin, the organized offender is recalled by everyone from his childhood as the bully, the class clown, the kid who made people notice him. As opposed to being loners, organized offenders are gregarious, and they like crowds. These are the guys who pick fights in bars, who drive cars irresponsibly, and who are described throughout life as troublemakers. They may land jobs that are above menial labor and commensurate with their intelligence, and then act out in such a way as to provoke a confrontation that will result in their being fired. Such stresses often lead to their first murders. A former Ohio police officer in the midst of job troubles, difficulties with the law, and women troubles, abducted a young woman and almost by accident murdered her. With disorganized killers, this important factor, the pre-crime situational stress, is often absent. Their crimes are triggered by their mental illness, not by events in the outside world that impact on them. Instead of feeling inferior to people, organized killers feel superior to nearly everyone. Gacy, Bundy, and Kemper all belittled the police who were too stupid to catch them, and the psychiatrists who were too inept to understand them. They overcompensate, often believing themselves to be the smartest, most successful people to have come down the pike, even when they are only moderately so, and not particularly distinguished except by the monstrousness of their crimes. After the crime, they often follow the progress or non-progress of the investigation in the news media. The disorganized offender takes little or no interest in the crime after it has been committed. There is another area in which the organized offenders seem to be successful, in the sack. Often they have had multiple sex partners. As good con artists with excellent verbal skills, they are often able to convince women, or men in some cases, to have sex with them. They may be superficially attractive and good amateur psychologists. However, they are unable to sustain normal long-term relationships. Their lives are characterized by having many partners, none of whom stick with them for very long. A disembowelment killer in Oregon had many affairs with women, none very deep or of long duration. Ted Bundy's main squeeze before his incarceration said that he was an unexciting sex partner. Most, if not all, of the organized killers have tremendous anger toward women, often expressed in the belief that a certain female is not woman enough to turn him on. The ranks of organized offenders contain many rapists who beat up women, they reported, because the women did not stimulate them to orgasm. Organized offenders are angry at their girlfriends, at themselves, at their families, and at society in general. They feel that they've been mistreated during their entire lives and that everything is stacked against them. If they're so smart and clever, why haven't they made $1 million or, as Charlie Manson wanted, had a career as a rock star? They all believe that society has conspired to keep them down. Manson felt that had he not been in jail during his early life, his songs would have been very popular. Manson's rhetoric led his followers to believe they were stimulating class warfare by their murders. Ed Kemper believed he was taking victims from the rich and the middle class, and in so doing striking a blow for the working stiffs. John Gacy thought he was ridding the world of no-account punks and little queers. In their murders, these men strike back not only at the individual victims, but at society as a whole. Two men included in our study of the backgrounds and offenses of serial murderers provide classic instances of the patterns of organized and disorganized offenders. In our road shows, when I used to display the slides and give the lecture about the organized offender, Gerard John Schaefer, someone in my audience would accuse me of having taken the characteristics of that sort of offender right from the details of Schaefer's case. That's not so, but it is true that the patterns associated with the organized killer are starkly apparent in his instance. In the early 1970s, the Florida police were in the process of putting together a task force to investigate a handful of cases in which women were reported missing. Then they got a break. Two distraught and alarmed young women stumbled out of the swampy woods, found a passing motorist who took them into town, and made their way to a police station, where they told a harrowing tale of abduction. They had been hitchhiking and were picked up by a normal-looking, neatly clothed man in a car that resembled a police vehicle. He told them he'd drive them to their destination. Instead, he took them into the woods and tied them up at gunpoint. After roping these two, however, the man looked at his watch and said, "Uh-oh, I gotta go. I'll be back." And he jumped in his car and drove away. The women managed to wriggle their way out of their bonds and get to the road. They took the police back to the spot where they had been tied up and showed them how they had been immobilized. One strange sidelight to this part of the story, the police asked them to recreate what had happened, to demonstrate the immobilization in detail, and the women, who still must have been terrified by their recent and narrow escape, donned the ropes willingly, and the police photographed them in position. They had their hands tied high, with the rope thrown over a tree from which, they said, the man had intended to hang them. Searching and excavating the area nearby, the police found partially decomposed body parts and some pieces of women's clothing. On one pair of jeans, there was quite a distinctive hand-stitched pattern. That pattern matched the description of a pair of jeans that a girl had been reported as wearing when she was reported missing. Discovering this evidence, the police began to take the stories of the escaped women even more seriously. The two women were able to describe in excellent detail the car in which they had been abducted and the physical attributes of their abductor. For instance, they said that the car had a bumper hitch, which they remembered because their abductor had tied one end of the rope to it and thrown the other over the tree. He had said he was going to use the car to haul them up to a height from which he could hang them. The car also had a fraternity sticker in the window, they said. Before going further with the story, let me point out the attributes of the organized offender that are present so far in the narrative. The abductor personalized the victims by talking with them, used his own vehicle, and conned the women into his car by means of his verbal skills. He brought his own threatening weapon to the scene and took it away with him. And he had a rope, in my judgment, a sure sign under the circumstances that he was planning to complete sexual acts with the women prior to torture and murder. After the murder, he was going to hide and dispose of the bodies. He displayed mobility and adaptive behavior during the crime when he left the women tied up and went to pay attention to some other aspect of his life, telling them that he would return and finish them off later. Gerard Schaefer became a suspect. He was a police officer in a neighboring jurisdiction, and a close check of his background now revealed that he had left another police organization. According to my conversations with officers connected to the case, in his earlier job, Schaefer had been cited for stopping cars driven by women committing traffic infractions, then running the women's license plate numbers through a computer check to obtain more particulars about them, and getting their phone numbers so he could later call them for dates. As an aside, let me say that some police use their badges and authority as a way to obtain information and, shall we say, introductions to women. But very few use their authority to take women into the woods for rape, torture, and murder. The authorities deduced that when Schaefer had left the women tied up in the wooded area, he had gone to answer a police roll call and had planned to return to the site in uniform and driving his official vehicle to finish them off. Schaefer's own car matched the description given by the two abducted women, and a search of his home turned up evidence that helped to convict him of the murder of the missing girl who had once worn those distinctive jeans, as well as the murder of another woman. Schaefer was also convicted of abducting the two hitchhikers who had managed to escape before being murdered. Schaefer denied the crimes entirely, but his denials were contradicted by the living witnesses as well as by the evidence, and he was eventually convicted and is still in prison in Florida. How many women he may have killed is still in question. The estimate went as high as 35. Since he denied the crimes and would not help the police in their searches, we don't know whether some missing bodies that were found could be attributed to him, nor do we know whether any of the women whom he might have killed are still lying somewhere, their bodies unidentified. From my point of view as a researcher into the minds of murderers, Schaefer's home was a gold mine, not only because it contained evidence of his crimes, but also because it gave us testimony to the sort of offender he was. Women's garments were found in the home, and jewelry as well. In my terminology, these were clearly trophies that he used to relive his crimes. Questioned about these items, Schaefer said that as a patrolman he had picked up the clothing along the highway and from time to time would give it to Goodwill. He had simply not had a moment in which to donate this batch. He had even given one of the necklaces to a girlfriend. In his home were stacks and stacks of softcore pornography and detective magazines. Leafing through them, the authorities discovered that he seemed most interested in stories about women being hanged, strangled, and otherwise choked. That the hanging and associated torture were major elements of his fantasy was shown by stories that he'd written himself and by drawings that he made over the surfaces of pinups. All of them had the same theme. For instance, there was a relatively normal pinup photograph of a young woman leaning against a tree with her hands behind her back. Schaefer had drawn lines over this to show bullet holes in her, ropes around her arms, and that she had defecated in her panties. The latter, an action commensurate with the loosening of muscles that usually accompanies death by hanging. On another photograph of three posed and nude women who face a single man, he had written a balloon commentary, "These women will please me. If not, they will be taken to the plaza square and entertain the villagers as they dance on the end of my rope." In other collages, he made cutouts to enhance the photo of a young woman who had been depicted as lying down, so that she looked as if she, too, had been hanged. Still other photographs in his home depicted women who were actually being hanged. Schaefer's home and life, then, displayed many articles that reflected the attributes of the organized offender. He had a relationship with a woman, had steady employment, kept trophies of his crimes, used pornographic materials, and in his crimes clearly sought to realize his fantasies. His choice of victims seems to have been of young hitchhiking women who might not be missed for some time after they disappeared, since they were likely to be transients in the area. During his trial, Schaefer flirted with the press and was gregarious and outgoing. His standard line to reporters was that this was all a mistake and that he would be exonerated. In one newspaper photograph taken at the time of the judicial proceedings, four law enforcement officers are guarding the prisoner as they are moving him from one location to another. Schaefer is the only one among the five men who is smiling, well-groomed, at ease in his surroundings. The organized offender, attempting to control the situation even when apprehended and on trial for his life. Schaefer is currently serving two concurrent life sentences for murder. Herbert Mullen had been all right, most people who knew him during his childhood in Santa Cruz agreed, until he graduated from high school in the late 1960s. Though relatively short and small, 5'7 and 120 pounds, he had been a first-string guard on the varsity football team. In addition, he was a good student, popular with both sexes, always polite to everyone, and voted most likely to succeed. By his senior year, however, the appearance of having it all together was masking quite another reality. Herb Mullen was on the skids. The reason was a paranoid schizophrenic disorder beginning to take hold in him and accelerated, not caused, by experimentation with marijuana and LSD. Once out of high school, he went through a series of personality transformations of the sort that are characteristic of paranoid schizophrenics. Let me say at once that schizophrenia is completely misunderstood by the lay public. Schizophrenia is the most prevalent of all the psychoses, and paranoid schizophrenics are the most common of the schizophrenics. Most paranoid schizophrenics are not violent, however. In fact, the vast majority are harmless. The percentage of harmless people among schizophrenics may well be lower than it is among the normal population. No matter, though, for the crimes that are committed by paranoid schizophrenics are so gross that, when brought to light, they bring censure down on all of the mentally ill. Herbert William Mullen was one of those who give mental illness a bad name. During the late 1960s in Northern California, a great many young high school graduates were trying to find themselves, and some of Mullen's transformations didn't seem all that far from the norm for young men Herb's age. He went to college, but couldn't hack it. For a while, he wore beads and long hair, and when that did not gain him the sexual experiences he sought, he cut his hair, put on a suit and tie, and appeared as a businessman. From time to time, as each experiment failed, he would enter a mental hospital for a spell, only to be released because he seemed relatively harmless to himself and others. Deciding he should be married, he would ask girls on the street or at a party whether they would marry him. When he was turned down by women, he decided this must mean that he was a homosexual, and so he went into the gay districts of San Francisco and asked men on the street whether they would like to live with him. The gays didn't want him either. He stood up in a Catholic church and shouted that this was not proper Christianity. Then he studied to be a priest, but gave that up. Similarly, he showed up one day at a gymnasium and studied to be a boxer. He fought with such ferocity in his first bout that his handlers told him he had a good career ahead of him, but he soon walked away from the ring as well. A year after registering as a conscientious objector, Herb applied to join the armed services. His father was in the military, but all the services rejected him except the Marines, who allowed him to go through basic training and then realized his mental instability, refused to put him on active duty, and cashiered him out. He lived with a mentally ill older woman for a time, during which he took up Eastern religions and mysticism. He went to Hawaii to pursue these, but didn't get very far. He returned to the mainland and told a friend that he had also been in a mental institution in Hawaii. By this time, in his mid-twenties, Mullen was completely socially unfit. He had tried everything and everyone, but fit in nowhere and with no one. Though he worked sporadically, he couldn't hold a job for more than a few weeks at a time, and his parents continued to support him. By this time, too, he had a full-blown case of paranoid schizophrenia. Schizophrenics characteristically take information from various sources and synthesize it in their minds, weaving it together in such a way that it makes a delusion and distorts the actual meaning of the information. Mullen had seen or read information about the possibility of future earthquakes in California, and he had a delusion about preventing these. He came to believe that California had been kept from having a calamitous earthquake in the previous half-dozen years because the war in Vietnam had produced a sufficient number of American casualties. That is, nature demanded blood sacrifices in order to keep from destroying the natural world. In October of 1972, however, the Vietnam War was rapidly winding down, insofar as American involvement was concerned, and Mullen's mind discerned a potential catastrophe looming. California would suffer a cataclysmic earthquake that would drop it into the ocean, he concluded, unless the amount of human sacrifices to nature was raised. It was for this reason, Mullen later said, that his father began to order him, by telepathy, to take some lives. Very often we find that the disorganized offender has led a life decidedly free of antisocial behavior prior to his crimes. Such offenders are not criminally oriented, not hostile or particularly violent prior to the time that they erupt into murder. Mullen followed that pattern. He had been unable to fit properly into the social fabric, had not been accepted either professionally or sexually by anyone. He had been stopped several times for possession of pot, but he had not raped, robbed, stolen, gotten into fights, or exceeded speed limits prior to the moment he was able legally to buy a gun and began killing people. Although the tale of murders I am about to recount has a certain amount of coherence, I want to point out that at the time of Mullen's murders, the police suffered from what is known as linkage blindness. They were unable to relate one of these killings to another because of two factors. First, the murders did not seem to be connected by use of a similar weapon or a similar M.O. The victims differed from one another in age, sex, and other characteristics, and so did the circumstances of their deaths. The second reason was that Ed Kemper was also operating in the same approximate area at the same time. Herbert Mullen's first victim was a male hitchhiker of 55, apparently a vagrant. Mullen must have noticed the man walking down the highway and driven past him. Then he parked his car on the shoulder and began to look under the hood as the man approached. The man asked whether he could help in return for a ride, and Mullen let him get under the hood to peer at the engine. Then Mullen reached inside the car for a baseball bat and smashed the man's head in. Mullen dragged him into the woods not far from the highway and left him. The body was found the next day. 2 weeks after the first murder, Mullen's father directed him to kill his second victim as a sacrifice, and also to test the hypothesis that the environment was rapidly being polluted and that an earthquake might be nigh. Accordingly, he picked up a female hitchhiker on a highway and then plunged a knife into her chest as he was driving. In the woods, he undressed her, spread-eagled her legs, and cut her abdominally in order to investigate his hypothesis of pollution.